The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Afternoon. We're delighted to welcome a group from the Department of Public Instruction celebrating State Government Day. They are called Career and Technical Student Organization. Do I have it right? Good. Would you all rise so we can meet you? Well, thank you, and you may be seated. Have you gotten material about the case that you are about to hear? Good. Then we hope that you will enjoy these arguments, and that puts some additional pressure on our attorneys. Stellar performances. I'll call the last case for today, 01-0793, State Ex Rel Leslie Schatz versus McCourtry. Assistant Attorney General Tom Dawson representing Mr. McCourtry, and T. Christopher Kelly representing Mr. Schatz. Before we begin, I do want to thank Mr. Kelly for handling this case pro bono, and he was appointed by the Court of Appeals and continued representation into this court, and the court appreciates your representation. The court appreciates yours too, Mr. Dawson, but you're being paid. So with that, we'll hear from Mr. Dawson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this honorable court. My name is Thomas Dawson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Wisconsin Department of Justice. As the Chief Justice has indicated, I represent the respondent, Gary McCourtry, in this case. Also, I'd like to introduce at counsel table with me is UW Law Student, Department of Justice Clinical Extern, Mayan Silver. The issue presented in this case is whether, in order to comply with the due process and equal protection clauses of the United States Constitution, the circuit courts of this state, who are required by Wisconsin Statute Section 802.05 sub 3, more commonly known as the Wisconsin Prisoner Litigation Reform Act, or PLRA, to screen those pleadings that are filed by prisoners and to dismiss cases that fail to state a claim, whether those courts must now provide additional notice to the prisoners of the court's proposed motions or decisions to dismiss cases for failure to state a claim, and give the prisoners an additional opportunity to be heard on the motion, regardless of how devoid of merit the pleadings may be. The Court of Appeals said the answer is yes. The Court of Appeals was wrong. We ask this court to reverse that decision. Consistent with the court's longstanding inherent powers, sua sponte dismissals of prisoner lawsuits that fail to state a claim do not violate due process or equal protection. In addition, the Court of Appeals decision imposes administrative burdens and costs on the courts of this state that the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act was enacted to avoid. The Court of Appeals was wrong for two fundamental reasons. First, the PLRA provides prisoners advance notice, an opportunity to be heard on the sufficiency of their complaints and their petitions. The Court of Appeals decision is based on a false premise. That false premise is that under the PLRA, prisoners do not get notice or opportunity to be heard on the sufficiency of their pleadings. This simply is not true. First, the PLRA provides notice by warning prisoners that the courts will screen their cases to determine whether they state a claim, and it warns them that they had better file a sufficient complaint and petition that do state claims, or else they face dismissal. Prisoners are heard on the issue when they file their pleadings, under the warning that they could be dismissed. The second reason the Court of Appeals decision is wrong is that prisoners get a second notice of the court dismissals themselves when they receive them and have a second opportunity to be heard on the dismissal by either amending their defective pleadings or seeking reconsideration of the dismissals or seeking relief from judgment.
Are they told that?
I'm sorry?
Are they given that warning in the court, in the circuit court's opinion or in some other letter given to them, or do they have to read the statutes?
Well, first of all, they'd have
to... Which statute?
Obviously, the PLRA expressly states that the courts will screen the cases and may dismiss the cases for failure to state a claim. Constructive notice has been held to be adequate. If you're asking me, is...
Where does it say screen? I think that, isn't this a decision on the merits?
Is...
The decision that Judge Calloway gave here, isn't it on the merits?
No. It appears because of the record and because of the extensiveness of the decision, one might think at first blush it was, but it was a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim.
Okay. So it's without prejudice, is what you're saying.
It's about what?
Without prejudice, because it's a motion to dismiss, doesn't mean you can't file a new complaint. Is
exactly.
That right?
Mr. Schatz, in this case, could have done a number of things. He could have sought to amend his petition. He could have sought a reconsideration of the decision by Judge Calloway. He could have sought relief from judgment.
It sounds to me, then, you agree with the Court of Appeals that he has an opportunity to object to this dismissal. You just don't like the opportunity the Court of Appeals gave him. You're giving us different opportunities.
I'm saying that the Due Process Clause does not require Mr. Schatz to be given a third opportunity to have notice and opportunity to be heard on the petition that was dismissed.
Well, you could ask for a motion for reconsideration, right?
Yes.
That gives him an opportunity to be heard on the exact complaint he filed.
Yes. The problem with the Court of Appeals decision, though, is it flies in the face of the PLRA, which was intended to avoid additional litigation. We're adding still another layer on top of a procedure that the PLRA was sought to avoid.
Trying to get at is, so if you got an opinion from the Court of Appeals that said he has the opportunity to ask for reconsideration.
Court of Appeals didn't say that.
No, but suppose it had. He could file a motion for reconsideration and ask that the court review its dismissal, right? And we would like you, as a matter of procedure, when the trial judge does it, the trial judge should so advise the petitioner. Okay? Would the state be up here?
Probably not, because we wouldn't be adding another layer. The Court of Appeals has added another layer that was not supposed to be there, and that's what's the problem with the Court of Appeals decision.
And what's the layer?
The layer is requiring now the courts, when they're ready to exercise their duty under the PLRA to dismiss a case, to give additional notice to the prisoner of the opportunity to comment on a proposed sua sponte motion.
So you don't have an objection to it doing after the fact, saying you have the right to motion for reconsider.
We recognize that the other procedures that are in the statutes for review and to be heard on decisions are in place and are not wiped away by the PLRA.
The state doesn't object to the trial court giving that information to the prisoner.
Nope. I think that would be within the discretion of the trial court. I don't think it's mandated. It's not mandated by the due process clause, because the prisoner has constructive notice of that right under the statutes. But requiring the courts to do that simply would not be appropriate.
Practically speaking, could the prisoner 4 or 5 months down the road file another petition which said indirectly refer to this incident or others and just keep on filing petitions?
Well, not if the statute of limitations has run or if the
right.
dismissal should be it was on the merits. In some cases, the dismissal will be on the merits. In other cases, it will be without prejudice. It really depends on the nature and the reason for the dismissal.
I was going to reflect that many times, at least it's my understanding, that there could be multiple requests, you know, following a resolution of one, you could be getting another one. I mean, hypothetically, you could do that.
Well, I can tell you, Your Honor, that prisoners often do file requests. They often do file motions for reconsideration. That is probably one of the most common means by which they seek relief from the trial court that dismissed their cases. That procedure is still there. And what we now have is a situation where they can file the complaint, and now the Court of Appeals has said, well, you've got to give them notice of your intention to dismiss, give them the opportunity. Another problem with that Court of Appeals decision is that it provides absolutely no guidance to the trial courts as to how they're supposed to fulfill this responsibility. Is it with a letter? And how detailed must that letter be? Must it be an actual proposed decision, a detailed decision that then the prisoner has the right to or ability to respond to? There's no guidance here, which is an additional burden that really should not exist.
Mr. Dawson, could I ask you on the provisions of sub 3 here, 80205 sub 3, what is the scope of that? As I read it, I don't see that the scope is confined to writs of certiorari or cases questioning prison discipline or anything. I don't see any limit to the scope except what's set out in 801, that provision in 801.
Are you talking about the PLRA? The provision that says the court may dismiss under the various conditions.
Yes.
Well, this applies to certiorari proceedings, any actions that are filed by prisoners under 80102. There's also a provision in 80102 that deals with prisoner litigation as well. This is the one that requires the courts to dismiss where they file a frivolous action, where they file an action to harass or fail to state a claim.
Well, let me ask this. Would this apply if someone is sitting in the Dane County Jail and they file a medical malpractice case? Does this apply to that?
If they fit the definition of prisoner under the PLRA, yes. I can't answer that. I'm not prepared to answer that question as to whether a person who's been arrested and put in jail fits that definition. There was no question in this case that Mr. Schatz was a prisoner for the purposes of the PLRA and therefore falls within the requirements of this law.
Well, prisoner just says means any person who is incarcerated, imprisoned or otherwise detained in a correctional institution, or is arrested or otherwise detained by law enforcement. It doesn't include 980 relief. It doesn't include person bringing an action from judgment terminating parental rights, relief from a judgment of conviction or sentence, a person bringing an action under 80950, who is not serving the sentence for the conviction of a crime. So if I'm in prison, I'm raising the issue that Justice Prosser raised. If I'm in prison and I'm bringing a products liability case, it doesn't say I'm not a prisoner here under
right.
7A.
Right.
I mean, there are specific exemptions in it. Maybe I'm not reading it carefully enough, but it doesn't seem to cover me.
But under the PLRA, if you fit the definition and you file a lawsuit, it's got to be screened by the trial courts, and the trial courts are required to screen it to determine whether it states a claim, and they then may dismiss sua sponte. that motion, where the notice is provided to them. It certainly was provided to Mr. Schatz in this case.
It just seems to me what I'm getting at here is you argue that the Court of Appeals has really imposed a blanket rule that's unreasonable because, for example, on that part of Mr. Schatz's petition for certiorari where he was late in filing, why would you go back to him and permit him to amend that? I mean, there's really nothing that can be done about that.
Well, there's
conversely, if you have a uniform rule and it applies to divorce actions and contract actions and malpractice and all kinds of things that have nothing whatsoever to do with prisoner litigation, I mean, with prison confinement or something of that sort, I mean,
well, this is a prisoner case, and we're here to decide that on those facts. However, the Court of Appeals used a rationale that could apply across the board to any sua sponte type of a motion. Their decision ostensibly was based on, quote, due process. They didn't reach the equal protection issue, but it was on due process. And they said that you're entitled to prior notice before the court exercises its sua sponte authority. And the courts of the state have had inherent authority to dismiss on their own motions cases that are utterly, clearly and obviously meritless. And that, by the way, is the standard that applies, the legal standard that applies to the trial courts when they're determining whether or not to dismiss. It's not discretionary. There are objective legal standards by which they are to make these decisions. They're either right or wrong. And therefore, if you look at the rationale of the Court of Appeals, there's no limit to that rationale. Now, we're here on this prisoner case. And the PLRA requires the courts to exercise this authority that requires them to actually screen and then gives them the authority to dismiss where they fail to state a claim. Prisoners are on constructive notice by the PLRA that can happen, and they have the ability then to file a petition or a complaint that does state a claim. Then, after they've done that, even after the court has dismissed, they get another shot. They get notice by getting that decision. They have the ability to be heard in a very meaningful way by either moving for reconsideration or seeking relief from judgment. That is due process.
Mr. Dawson, how do you get around the Sahagian versus Young decision? I know that's older decision, but how do you get around that? That seems to run counter to your argument today.
This is not a Sahagian case. Sahagian was a decision on the merits. It was a prisoner case, but it was not a PLRA case. It was a pre-PLRA case. In that case, the trial court, on a writ of certiorari, where it had the record in front of it, applying the standards that do apply in such cases, dismissed that case on the merits without giving either actual or constructive notice that it was about to do that. That Sahagian never had the ability to file an argument on the merits of his case. It had passed the motion stage. He was already presumed to be stating a claim. The case was to be decided on the merits. The court did.
So you draw a distinction between a dismissal on failure to state a claim and a situation where the dismissal is on the merits.
I do with regard to one prong. Certainly in that case, there was no advance constructive or actual notice that the court could actually rule on the merits, and Sahagian did not have that chance. The problem is that there's another prong that the Court of Appeals did not look at. The court did not look at the case law that is recognized in Nalin, which is a state court case. It didn't look at the case law in Blaney or Curley versus Perry, which recognized that even if, without that notice, the prisoner gets actual notice of the dismissal and has the ability, has the right, to seek relief from the trial court, that constitutes meaningful hearing on that issue. That's recognized in Nalin. In Nalin, which involved dismissal, there was neither notice before nor after the dismissal, and that's important. Because under Link versus Wabash Railroad, there's a recognition that where a person has post-decisional relief available to him, and he can be heard in a meaningful way, then due process is satisfied. The Court of Appeals did not address that. The Court of Appeals didn't touch that.
Well, does the notice in the PLRA itself make this distinguishable from the Young case?
It does. And certainly we have in this case both advanced constructive notice of the chance that this case could be dismissed and the opportunity for the petitioner to file a claim that stated a claim and the ability after the decision to reconsider. In this case, Mr. Schatz did neither. I'm saying the case law shows that either would have been satisfactory to satisfy the due process clause. And I think the Nayland case supports that. Link versus Wabash Railroad supports that. Curley supports that. And Blaney certainly supports that because there was no advance notice in that case.
Should the petition be liberally construed?
Absolutely. Which makes the case somewhat analogous to the Bardis case. Now, Bardis was an appeal. However, this Court upheld the right of the Court of Appeals to dismiss, without hearing, without advance notice, an appeal, even though this Court found that the Court of Appeals was actually wrong. The Court of Appeals was under a similar standard, to only dismiss where it's obvious that it should be dismissed. Even though the Court of Appeals was wrong in that case, this Court upheld the right of the Court of Appeals to do that. In fact, so what I'm suggesting is that is an additional factor that is playing in favor of the State's argument here, that under the standards whereby a judge is only supposed to dismiss where it is clear it should be dismissed and all the inferences run in favor of the petitioner, then that's an additional safeguard that was recognized such as in the Curley case.
Let me ask this. Suppose the petition simply said that the conduct, misconduct charges should not be upheld because there were numerous due process violations, period. Now, how do you construe that petition? I've got them right here in my pocket.
Liberally construing what you're asking is, didn't Mr. Schatz actually hurt himself by filing the extensive type of petition that he did? And he may very well have done that. Liberally construing a petition that you're describing, it may very well be that it would have survived. However, that's really not the issue. The issue is whether the court...
That was his petition.
That's right.
There were numerous.
Yes.
I mean, he didn't provide any evidence. And then he also said this was retaliatory.
Yes.
Without any evidence.
Yes.
Well, now, how should the judge construe that petition?
He should construe it liberally, and he should work all inferences in his favor. But remember, that is not the issue in this case. The only issue in this case is whether he was denied due process by not being given additional notice and hearing. That is not at issue here. Mr. Schatz did not contest the validity of Judge Callaway's decision dismissing his case for failure to state a claim.
That's one of the issues, isn't it? Whether we should look at the merits if we see fit, or does it have to go back to the Court of Appeals and look at the merits?
No, Mr. Schatz waived his right to appeal Judge Callaway's decision on whether or not it failed to state a claim. He never developed that argument. Even the Court of Appeals agreed with the State on that. It's in footnote 3 of the opinion. So there is no other issue to be decided. I know Mr. Kelly may differ with me on that, but that is not to be decided. I'll mention...
I just want to ask a question. I've just forgotten the rule. if the trial court is silent about whether it's dismissal with or without prejudice, how is that interpreted? There's a case law that says how you interpret it, and I've just forgotten which way it went.
And I have forgotten it, too.
Well, here's my point. If you and I can't remember, and I honestly cannot, and I assume you honestly cannot, then how does a prisoner who gets this know whether this is on the merits or off the merits? Now, if you look at, that is with or without prejudice, if you look at 802.053, it says the court may dismiss if frivolous. Now, I assume that's on the merits, that you can't come back if it's frivolous.
I would assume that, yes.
That's right. If it's used for an improper purpose, such as to harass, delay, et cetera, I assume that's a dismissal on the merits.
Yes.
If it seeks monetary damages from a defendant who is immune from relief, that's on the merits.
Yes.
Fails to state a claim, I don't know.
It depends.
It depends. Sometimes it's on the merits, and you can't replead because no matter what you do, you're not going to make it. Other times, it's not on the merits. It's not with prejudice, and you can replead. So how does a prisoner know if the court doesn't tell him? And if you and I can't remember what it means when it's silent. Well, and this is silent, just as dismiss, dismiss, dismiss.
But the petitioner has a shot anyway. I mean, the petitioner can still file a motion for reconsideration or relief from judgment, regardless of whether it's on the merits or not. He's not being deprived of due process. Whether it's on or off the merits, he's not being deprived of due process. He has the opportunity to be heard. He has constructive notice ahead of time, and he has actual notice when he gets it in the mail. It's a matter of law, as you point out, as to whether or not it's on the merits or not, but those are objective standards. It may be that he's acting pro se and doesn't know what to do, but that is not the issue.
Where does he get the right to a motion to reconsider? I just want to make sure that something in the Prisoner Litigation Act doesn't take that away from him.
806.07.
And that's not eliminated by the
not,
Prisoner
Not
Act.
That I know of, and we've argued that is available to them.
And that's your general relief from a judgment or order.
For mistake.
So that's where you're going to come under, that the judge made a mistake?
Yes, mistake of law or of fact. Mm-hmm. I might point out that the policy decision has been made. I'm sorry, my time is up. Thank you.
You can finish your sentence, counsel.
I just wanted to make the point that the PLRA made the decision about requiring courts to screen these cases for the purpose of saving this additional cost and trouble for the court system. We can ill afford it. Thank you.
Chief, may I ask?
Justice Prosser has a question.
I am really quite intrigued by the footnote footnote one in Mr. Kelly's brief about the best for substitution.
Can you give me a page number, Your Honor?
One.
Thank you.
This is the one about the case being assigned to Judge Callaway on the 31st of January and being decided on the 1st of February, not giving the petitioner the time to substitute. Right. This seems completely bizarre to me, especially when you look at the actual written decision of Judge Callaway, page 17.
Well, what we have said in our brief is that's a non-issue as well, because after the Court of Appeals ruled and remanded the matter to Judge Callaway, we've heard no objection from Mr. Schatz. The substitution issue has been waived.
Excuse me,
Justice Bradley.
Your interpretation of mistake in 806.07 sub A, I have not given any thought to this, but it catches me by surprise because I have never interpreted 80607 sub A mistake as the court's mistake. Rather, 80607 sub A, I have always seen, but I don't confess to cover the universe on this, that mistake, inadvertent surprise, or excusable neglect has been the mistake or inadvertence of one of the parties. Typically, it comes in the context of failing to respond to a pleading or something. Do you have any authority for that mistake being interpreted as the court's mistake?
No, I don't. But I would also cite other provisions in 80607, such as the judgment is void, and H, which is the catch-all, any other reasons justifying relief from the operation of judgment. This is often the basis for the courts reconsidering their decisions for whatever good reasons any party may have for vacating or staying a judgment.
Raises a problem, though, counsel, because you either should move rapidly to get a change from the trial court, or you appeal. And what you're doing here by using 80607 is then getting another court order that extends appeal time, which under other cases is not too favorably looked upon. But we can check out those cases.
Well, we've also cited to 80209, and I believe there's another step. 80209, which is the right to amend at any time. But those issues exist in any case, whether it's a PLRA case or not. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly.
May it please the Court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent Leslie Schatz in this proceeding. It is a fundamental rule of constitutional law that the government may not deprive an individual of life, liberty, or property without due process. And it is equally fundamental that due process in the procedural context guarantees an individual the right to notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard before the deprivation occurs. The United States Supreme Court has told us that lawsuits or causes of action are a species of property protected by the Due Process Clause, and this court has also held that due process applies to litigation and to the dismissal of lawsuits. The Court of Appeals, I think, took those elementary propositions and applied them to reach what is an inescapable conclusion, and one that is consistent with the precedent of this Court and earlier decisions of the Court of Appeals. It held that a court may not dismiss a lawsuit without first giving the litigant who's affected by that dismissal notice and an opportunity to be heard before the dismissal occurs. That, I think, is an inescapable conclusion given the fundamental principles that apply the Due Process Clause to lawsuits.
And that is not in any way changed by the Prisoner Litigation Act? That has not been changed in any way by the Prisoner Litigation Act?
No. There's certainly nothing in the Prisoner Litigation Act which suggests a legislative intent to change it. Okay. And given that Nealon and Sahagian were the law at the time it was enacted, the legislature presumptively did not intend to change that.
And I just wanted to, I've got one other question, and it's on page 1. It deals with judicial substitution. I started to look it up, but as long as you're there, I'll ask the question. Practically, and I used to serve on the trial bench for many years, in this type of where we have a petition here, then you have the time for substitution. Are you suggesting that, A, he has a right to substitution, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, from a practical standpoint, and particularly in light of how these petitions come in, what would the court do then? Wait the time so to say, all right, the time for substitution is passed, and then we would act? Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that would be the prudent thing to do, and I would think that most of the time the court would need that relatively short time period anyway in order to review the pleadings and make a decision and write a decision if it's going to dismiss.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, Mr. Kelly, there are three conduct reports here that were this part of these petitions for certiorari. Let's say there was only the first conduct report, the one that has 578 at the end of it. There has to be a petition filed within 45 days, as I understand it.
That's right.
And if I'm not mistaken, it was 45 days plus 71 days before something was filed.
Apparently.
Now, are you arguing here that due process requires that the judge, in effect, consult with the late filing party and say, come back and explain why you filed 71 days after the deadline?
I do. I think that's a closer case because we're talking about not applying a legal standard. We're talking about a factual standard. It either is or isn't timely, and there isn't much room to argue about that. But if Mr. Schatz had been given notice that we're going to dismiss at least this claim because you're untimely, I don't know what Mr. Schatz would have done or somebody in his position would have done, but it's certainly conceivable that he might have said, my gosh, I attached the wrong decision. It's not the final decision. There was one that came after that. Let me amend my pleading and respond in that way. So it's certainly not inconceivable that somebody like Schatz could never make an argument that would defeat the dismissal, even if the dismissal is based on a failure to timely file. That's why I think it's important to provide due process to people, because it avoids mistakes. It promotes correct decision-making on the part of the court.
Now, your opponent is, your opposing counsel is indicating, well, wait a minute, there is due process here. You have the reconsideration. You have the de facto notice, in other words, constructive notice. What about that as far as what you're suggesting, and when I didn't know the breadth of your request, but as a practical matter, from a trial judge's standpoint, that means that you're going to require him or her to send back some type of notice saying, dear Mr. or Ms. So-and-so, we received your petition. I have viewed it. I find there are no issues. If you have anything further to say, please let me know.
Essentially, yeah. I think that would do it.
Yeah, I understand. Is that realistic? Is that what you're expecting?
That's what courts do all the time. I don't know what's
they
unrealistic.
They do in this type of case.
I don't know if they do it in this kind type of case, but in civil actions generally, courts don't dismiss cases without giving people an opportunity to be heard.
Well, before they dismiss it, not after.
Before they dismiss, not after.
Well, in an ordinary civil action, you get a summons and a complaint, and the judge doesn't do anything until there's an answer, right? Or
that's
a motion.
That's
right?
True.
And so can't the judge, they get an answer, it says no claim for relief is stated, can't the judge, without a hearing, dismiss that case and say, I've looked at the complaint, I've looked at the answer, or the motion to dismiss, you are dismissed?
No, I don't think the
Why?
Judge can
Where does
do
it
that.
Say you got to give him hearing?
I think that's essentially what this court said in Nealon. I think that's what the Court of Appeals said in Sahagian. And I think that's what all the due process cases say. The due process cases say that post-deprivation remedies are not adequate if it's possible to provide a pre-deprivation remedy.
Well, this court gets briefs. We hear cases on briefs. We don't give everybody a hearing here.
If you hear cases on briefs, you've given them a hearing. You've given them a meaningful opportunity to be heard.
What's the difference of hearing it on the pleadings?
Because the pleadings are not a full statement of the legal argument that an individual might make.
You, well, suppose the pleading is frivolous on its face. There's no way that pleading is based in law or fact. Can't the court dismiss it without a hearing?
I think that's possible. I think that frivolous cases are in a separate category, and I think the United States Supreme Court has recognized that, although the federal cases talk about a frivolous pleading not giving the court subject matter jurisdiction, and that's why. But I think that frivolous cases are in a separate category. I think it's arguable that if you're not filing an action in good faith, that's not the kind of property that you have a due process right to not be deprived of.
Is this a dismissal with or without prejudice?
It looks to me like a dismissal with prejudice. It doesn't tell the individual that he has leave to refile. The case having been dismissed, he can no longer amend the complaint because there's no live claim left to amend.
Well, under the Prisoner Act, can he bring a second complaint same cause of action?
I think he would have been well past his 45 days. It would have been time barred.
So he couldn't do that unless this gave him leave to amend.
Correct. And that, I think, is another reason why a post-deprivation remedy isn't adequate. If a litigant like Mr. Schatz is told ahead of time, I think your petition doesn't state a claim, and here's why, he then has a chance to amend his petition and try to state a claim. If he's left to file a motion after the fact, a motion for reconsideration, it's too late to amend because his complaint has already been dismissed. He can't amend it anymore.
Well, suppose that this was a dismissal with leave to amend, and you give your client opportunity to amend or to come in and argue, that is on paper, why the trial court erred. Would that be adequate?
That sounds to me like it gives him a meaningful opportunity to be heard, because he would have either the right to make his complaint better or the right to explain to the judge why he thinks the complaint is okay the way it is. And that's a meaningful opportunity to be heard.
You would take that rather than, or in lieu of, what the Court of Appeals suggested?
I think that would be adequate, sure. As long as the plaintiff's opportunity to be heard exists before his right to bring this action has been permanently extinguished.
I'm a little unclear, counsel, about the scope of this notice, according to the Court of Appeals opinion, and a little unclear on what it is that you're arguing for in terms of the scope of the notice and the procedure that the circuit court is supposed to employ in order to comply with due process. The court indicated that it didn't mean that there had to be oral argument, but it didn't give any guidance beyond that, apart from saying the conclusion of whether a pleading states a claim for relief may depend upon the particular arguments made and authorities cited, but the litigant here, that means the prisoner, does not know what those will be when the court undertakes a sua sponte analysis without giving notice of that. And that implies to me that the notice is not going to be a form notice to the prisoner saying, I'm about to dismiss your complaint for failure to state a claim, but that the Court of Appeals contemplates much more than that, a statement of reasons, so that the prisoner then responds to something specific. And that seems to me to set up a situation where the court is actually in litigation with the prisoner instead of presiding over litigation between two parties. And then I also have a question about whether the other side gets notice of this or whether this is supposed to be an ex parte notice to the prisoner. Do you have any clarification of the Court of Appeals opinion for us on that, or do you have a proposal about what's required by due process?
Well, since the judge is thinking about dismissing the case at that point, presumably the judge has put some thought into it and has a reason for wanting to dismiss it. So I think for a notice to be meaningful, the judge would have to say, here's why I'm thinking about dismissing your lawsuit. I don't think it meets the standard because. And I don't think it has to be a lengthy explanation, but I think it has to be enough to put the plaintiff on notice as to what legal issues he needs to address.
Yeah, well, a lot of times but I was just thinking, and as I indicated, I sat for 14 years or 13-plus years on trial bench and received many communications from people that were incarcerated. One of the things that I remember particularly was the inability to decipher the language. In other words, I'd get one or two page, and I would end up asking my reporter and clerk of courts to come in, can you read this? And we would not be able to decipher. So what we would, so just following through, you would write a letter back, say I could not read it. So then you get another letter back, presumably, hopefully better printed or typed. And then there would be a third letter which said, well, based on whatever it is, I'm going to dismiss it. So I'm just talking from a practical standpoint what is being set up here, because a lot of times these petitions are very difficult just to read. Not talking about understand, but just to be able to read the language.
I certainly agree with that. I think any time that a court deals with a pro se litigant, it's more difficult for the court.
Sure.
But pro se litigants, including prisoners, still have a due process right to be in court. The fact that they don't do it very well doesn't mean they don't have the same due process rights that everybody else has.
I guess I'm getting at what Justice Sykes was talking about, a process, or what you're, you know, how practically, because that would be one of the things that we would have to consider, since this would be something that all would be effective on all trial judges in the state of Wisconsin to deal with.
Sure. To the point that the trial judge almost becomes an advocate or engages in litigation with the plaintiff, that's what the legislature did. The legislature imposed that role upon trial courts by making them do what an opposing party would normally do, which is pick apart the complaint and see if it states a claim. Having been put in that position, it seems to me that before the judge dismisses the complaint, he or she has an obligation to at least provide sufficient information to the litigant to put the litigant on notice as to why a decision is being contemplated. Now, in this case, I guess Judge Calloway could have said, I have a 17-page decision here. Here it is. Tell me if it's wrong. That would be one way to do it. I don't think he would have had to do that. I think he could have said
that little ex-party communication.
It was a 51-page.
Second question. Does notice go to the other side? I mean, issue hasn't been joined yet. There is no answer.
And
theoretically,
I don't think it has to go to the other side, because I think what the legislature is saying is we don't want to bother the other side at this point. So
has it become law of the case? Let's say in response to this notice, the prisoner musters up a really good argument why the case shouldn't be dismissed for failure to state a claim. The judge is convinced and says, okay, I'm going to let you go forward. The respondent files an answer and says this complaint fails to state a claim. And wants an opportunity to litigate that. What are we going to do then?
In fairness to that individual, and I think consistent with due process, it shouldn't be law in the case, because I think that person should be entitled to have input too.
If I understood Mr. Dawson's argument, he's saying we don't need this special procedure of the Court of Appeals. There is, after the fact, opportunity here for your client to be heard, and that is good enough. And if I understand your argument, you're saying it is good enough if he gets an opportunity to be heard, right?
If he has the opportunity to be heard before the dismissal and while he still has a chance to amend his complaint, yes.
Right. Okay. That's
The difference.
All right.
And if that's not correct, then this Court was incorrect in Nealon, because there was an opportunity in Nealon, presumably, to move to reconsider. But this Court nonetheless held you can't dismiss these things without giving the other side an opportunity to be heard before the dismissal.
Right. So you give them an opportunity to amend or argue in favor of it.
Right.
All right. And that would satisfy your concept. And the reason you have to give them the opportunity is because you've got this short period of making this kind of complaint.
That's why it's probably more critical in prisoner or in certiorari litigation than it is in other kinds of civil litigation, yes.
the problem I have with the Court of Appeals solution is that it's sort of not the way we ordinarily do things, of making a tentative ruling and saying, what do you think? Court makes a ruling. If you don't like it, you come back and you argue it under some form of relief or other. And so to send out a letter that says, well, I'm really thinking of knocking you out of here without telling them why, doesn't do your client very much good. Sending him a 17-page opinion itemizing it in fair detail, which apparently was done in a day, is much better for your client and for you because you can see where the problems are in the complaint. So, and it raises the questions that Justice Wilcox and Justice Sykes raised about the other side is entitled to relief. So why don't we do it on a motion for reconsideration? And if your client wants a motion to make that motion, has to give the other side an opportunity, and both of them briefs. One would assume that these are beyond brief arguments as to why this does or doesn't fit and why this 17-page ruling is or is not correct, and you treat it as a not a dismissal but and you'll have to help me. We have to get it so that it's not a dismissal, or if it's a dismissal, it's without prejudice with an opportunity to amend. That will do it, right?
I think that would do it.
That'll make you happy.
That would make Mr. Schatz and me happy, yes.
But can you do it? A dismissal means it's gone.
I believe so.
So then you either refile with an opportunity to refile, because there's nothing, I would assume, to amend if it's gone. Walk me through, if you will, the time limitations for this all occurring. Let's say I'm a circuit court judge, and I get this on my desk. Busy week, and so I don't get it to it really to look at it for a couple of weeks, and so now we're 15 days from the time that I've received it, and I think, boy, this doesn't really allow me to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. So then what do? I dismiss it under sub 3. Now, walk me through what you think is going to be the post-dismissal procedure with any time limit impediments.
The time limit impediment for a certiorari proceeding is that it has to be filed within 45 days of the administrative action complained of. And the problem with the dismissal, an outright dismissal, is that the petitioner is unlikely to have the 45 days anymore at the time the dismissal comes through. So I think that if this is being done, if the court is notifying the petitioner that his petition is being dismissed, the only way to accommodate the time problem is for the court to also say, but I'm giving you leave to refile, notwithstanding the 45 days. Otherwise, a post-deprivation procedure is completely inadequate, because you can ask for reconsideration, but if you can't amend to solve the problem, you're out of court. And if you didn't have notice ahead of time what the problem was, you're out of court.
So you're out of court, because if it's dismissed, are you talking about bringing a motion for reconsideration? And what are the time limits for that to be accomplished?
I think, I'm not sure what the time limits are. I think it's a year if we're looking at
80607. But what about the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act? What are the time limits there? I'm less familiar with that.
Off the top of my head, I don't know that there are any time limits unique to the PLRA, other than that it tells courts that they should review the initial pleading as soon as practicable. But I think that the time limit is essentially the statute of limitations, if it's a civil action, or the 45 days if it's a certiorari proceeding.
Well, 80209 says you can, you have a, and I don't know if it applies to this litigation, but the court may give you opportunity to amend pleadings under 80209-1, and then 80209-3 has a relation back to the original. So that's how it gets over statute of limitations problems.
And again, I think...
Were all my pleadings correctly.
And I think that may solve the problem, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
And I think that may solve the problem, Your Honor. I think if the petitioner still has a meaningful opportunity to either amend the pleading to correct the problem or to persuade the court that the initial pleading was good, then he's had a meaningful opportunity to be heard.
I'm not so sure, after all of this, that due process requires that. So you better persuade me.
Well, apart from...
Now we got the procedure, maybe, but is that really required?
It's certainly required that before the right to be in court, before the cause of action is extinguished, that the litigant has a meaningful opportunity to be heard, and that includes some prior notice that there is a problem. And that is what this court held in Nealon, and it's what the Court of Appeals held in Sahagian. And I think that derives from due process decisions in a wide variety of contexts that say you can't deprive people of property without giving them notice and an opportunity to be heard. I don't know why this is any different. And if the state is correct in its theory that due process just doesn't apply to the dismissal of lawsuits, which is contrary to what this court said in Nealon, then we're not talking just about prisoner litigation. We're talking about all lawsuits. So if I bring a medical malpractice case on behalf of a client and file my complaint and the judge reads the complaint before I've served it and says, well, this doesn't state a claim, the judge would be able to dismiss it sua sponte, without notice, without giving my client an opportunity to be heard, and that would be just fine under the state's theory because there is no due process right to notice or an opportunity to be heard before the dismissal takes place, and that's just not the law.
Could I ask, what does pleading mean in sub 3? If the prisoner wants to file something without depositing any money, is that a pleading?
Well, I think the rules of civil procedure define pleading at some point, and I think it includes a complaint and answer, and frankly, I don't recall what else might be a pleading. But I don't think it becomes less of a pleading if you file it without a filing fee.
I'm sorry.
I don't think it becomes less of a pleading because you file it without a filing fee, if that's the question.
What I'm trying to get at is the motion to proceed without a filing fee, do you have to, if that's denied, you have to give the party an opportunity to come in and argue that?
I don't think so, because I don't think that deprives the litigant of his property interest. He can still bring the lawsuit. He just has to pay for it.
What if he doesn't have the money?
Then you have a different constitutional right, which is access to the courts, and I think that's beyond the scope of what we're dealing with here.
Counsel, in other contexts, for instance, in post-conviction relief jurisprudence, State versus Bentley, we have held that a court can get a motion for post-conviction relief, and if it fails to state on its face any position where relief can be granted, the court can, sui sponte, dismiss it without hearing or deny it without hearing. Does that jurisprudence have any application to your due process argument in this context?
I don't think so, because, again, I don't think you're talking about a species of property that's protected by the Due Process Clause.
Why not? And there are other examples in the criminal law where you can file a motion, but the court does a screening and won't give you a hearing.
That's true, but I don't think motions are lawsuits. And I think the United States Supreme Court has said that the cause of action is a species of property that's protected by due process. I don't think that any particular motion would be or necessarily is.
So opening up a judgment, you don't think you have to give a hearing? Motion to open a judgment.
I don't think that that extinguishes a property interest. So, no, I don't think you have to give a hearing. I think it would be wise as a matter of courtesy to do so, but no, I don't think it's constitutionally required.
There was a petition for review in this case filed by the state. If the state had not timely filed the petition for review, I suspect we would never even have seen it, and a court commissioner would have summarily dismissed it. Would you be arguing that Mr. Dawson should have been notified about that?
No, for two reasons. The first is that I don't think, again, a petition for review is constitutionally protected property. And secondly, I think that, again, we're in the realm not of applying a legal standard, which different legal minds might view in different ways. We're talking about a factual standard. The 30 days has either gone by or it hasn't gone by, and there isn't much to argue about there. So I don't think that due process is implicated at that point. I don't think that it matters whether you give somebody a hearing, because they're not going to persuade you that they're counting to 30 in a different way. And that's basically what this court said when in Neyland, it refused to apply the United States Supreme Court logic in Link about constructive notice. They said, well, maybe under the old statute for failure to prosecute, where it said after 5 years your case gets dismissed, maybe there doesn't have to be notice in a hearing in that case because everybody can count to 5 years. But if you're talking about a legal standard that's more amorphous than that, like failure to prosecute or failure to state a claim, where legal minds might differ and very often do differ, then the opportunity to be heard becomes critical, because it's your opportunity to have your day in court and persuade the judge that you're right. And that's very different than a time limit. Thank you. My time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Dawson.
In the short time I have left, I want to dispel a notion. And that notion is that somehow Mr. Schatz didn't get due process. He got due process. He got it twice. He had constructive notice by the PLRA that said, you either file a petition that states a claim or your case can be dismissed by the judge sua sponte. That's notice. That's all he needs. That would have been enough. In addition, however, he had the right, if in an appropriate case, to file for reconsideration, to amend or whatever. But even if he was precluded after that first time, notice, opportunity to be heard by filing his petition that met the standard, if he's still out under his reconsideration procedures, either he's out because of statute of limitations or some other reason, he's out with prejudice, he has had due process. What we're talking about here is the Court of Appeals lumping on additional due process. The right to amend, the right to have reconsideration, the right for relief of judgment, in effect, is a form of additional due process. The original due process was the constructive notice, and this court has recognized that the courts have inherent power to dismiss cases without notice and hearing under certain conditions, such as where they have actual or constructive notice, such as by a court rule or, in this case, by the statute.
Counsel, if I'm a nice middle-class middle-aged lady, and I have a Med-Mal practice lawsuit, as kind of referenced by your opposing counsel. And let's say there is a statute that says for nice middle-class, middle-aged ladies, if they file a lawsuit, the judge can dismiss it for four reasons, a la here. That's almost unfathomable to me.
Well, I'm not sure you even need the statute, because this Court has recognized the inherent power of the courts to dismiss sua sponte without other notice and hearing. This Court started out in Nawin by saying, quote, affording the opportunity to be heard does not mean that every order entered without notice and preliminary adversary hearing offends due process.
So you mean that if we get a judge up in Iron County, and a real activist judge and who has some time on his hands, and he's going to go through the lawsuits before, as they come in, and sit there in the clerk's office on Wednesday afternoons and say, this one I'm dismissing. This one looks like it might be okay. You know, we got to keep our calendars current. That's okay?
In certain circumstances, it is.
What circumstances?
Such as where it is very patently clear that the complaint does not state a claim, that it's frivolous, it's there to harass. Those kinds of cases can go out the door, and this Court has said that they can go out the door.
You hit me, it hurt, pay money.
It either states a claim or not, according
to claim? I mean, is that the kind of case you think a judge can throw out?
Well, maybe I escape by saying that the PLRA puts a person on notice that they have to file a complaint that states a claim. And if they don't state a claim, according to objective legal standards, that is the notice they've had. They've had the opportunity to be heard by filing it. And the courts have said that is adequate. You have, in addition, situations where without advance notice, if there is an opportunity to have reconsideration on the merits of that, then that also provides for due process. It's an either or. It's in Nawin. It's in the Nawin case. It's in the Curley case. Either or. In this case, we have both.
Well, sub 3, 802053, deals just with the prisoner action.
Yes.
Whatever that means. Now we're going to have a sub 4, because we have a Med-Mal problem in the state, right? Insurance rates are going up, real problems. So we're going to have a 4 which says, in a Med-Mal case, the court may, without an answer, do any of the four things: frivolous, proper purpose, monetary damages from immune person, or fails to state a claim. You think a statute that said the trial court can dismiss a claim for failing to state a cause of action?
Is yours a prisoner or non-prisoner case?
No, non-prisoner. I'm amending the statute now. Legislature's doing an amendment.
Well, that's not the case.
Well, it may be a different case, but all you're doing is picking a different plaintiff. This case, the plaintiff is a prisoner. The next case, the plaintiff is going to be a middle-aged lady who got hurt by a doctor. And all I'm going to say is I had an operation, supposedly for my left leg. My right leg is gone. Pay me.
That person has not been deprived of the opportunity to file a petition or a complaint to seek relief.
Okay, now the court dismisses that because it fails to state a cause of action. That okay?
And that person may or may not have the right to have reconsideration, to amend, or even to appeal.
But if I understand your argument, this is what I'm getting at, just the fact that there's notice in the statute that the court can dismiss it is good enough for due process. I hear that as your position. If it's not, you should tell me.
That's what Nawin appears to say. That's what Lathan appears
to say.
That's
the state's position.
Yes.
And if I take away all the reconsiderations, et cetera, it's still okay because you've had notice.
Although those are not the facts of this case.
Oh, I understand that.
Facts
but
of
I
this
wanted,
case are.
What the bottom line due process is.
That's what the court appears to have said in Link. That's what the court appears to have said in Bardis. That's what the court appears to have said in Latham and in Nalin. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson, for an excellent argument, and thank you, Mr. Kelly, likewise for an excellent argument on this case. And as I said before, Mr. Kelly took this case at the request of the Court of Appeals and stayed with it as a part of his lawyer's obligations to perform pro bono, which means it for the public interest in